And hello, SunSounds listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about a couple months, titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Imagine. And then it's Much Too Busy, Alone, You Are Home, Chindori, A Story of 1,000 Birds, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with All the Beating Hearts. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, which is titled Imagine. If I picked chamomile flowers as a child in the windy fields and whispered to their fuzzy faces, imagine. If I let tadpoles swim across my hands in the wavy creek, imagine. If I jumped up high into my pappy's army truck and left our village of farm workers and waved adios to my amiguitos, imagine. If I let the stars at night paint my blanket with milky light, with shapes of hungry birds, while I slept outside, imagine what you could do. If I helped Mama feed the hopping chickens and catch the crazy turkey in the front yard of our new village, imagine. If I walked through the evening forest at the top of a mountain with a silvery bucket to fetch water from the next town. Imagine if I moved to the winding city of tall, bending buildings and skipped to a new concrete school I had never seen. Imagine if I opened my classroom's wooden door, not knowing how to read or speak in English. Imagine if I practiced spelling words in English by saying them in Spanish, like pay seal for pencil. Imagine if I collected gooey and sticky ink pens because I loved how the ink flowed like tiny rivers across soft paper. Imagine if I grabbed a handful of words I had never heard and sprinkled them over a paragraph so I could write a magnificent story. Imagine if I stood up in a school far away from where I lived and sang for the first time in front of class. Imagine if I started to write a poem on a skinny paper pad after school, as I walked on the wide sidewalk and then finished it when I got home. Imagine if I picked up my honey-colored guitar and called out my poem every day until it turned into a song. Imagine if I gathered many words and many more songs with both of my hands and let them fly over my mesa and turn them into a book of poems. Imagine if I stood up wearing a robe in front of my familia and many more on the high steps of the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and read out loud and signed my poetry book like this: Poet Laureate of the United States of America. Imagine what you could do. And I should note, the author, Juan Felipe Herrera, is a poet, performance artist, and activist. The son of migrant farm workers, he was the U.S. Poet Laureate from 2015 to 2017. He is the author of more than a dozen collections of poetry, in addition to short stories, young adult novels, and children's literature, including Jabberwocking, which he both wrote and illustrated. Juan Felipe Herrera lives with his life partner, poet Margarita Robles, in Fresno, California. This is a story about a pigeon titled Much Too Busy. Pigeon is extremely busy. Pigeon is doing extremely busy business things, rushing here, rushing there. Can't stop. Do not disturb. He is very, very busy. Pigeon was so busy that he forgot to look where he was going. Pigeon was so busy that before he knew it, he didn't really know where he was at all. "Oh, I'm much too busy for this," huffed Pigeon. "I absolutely do not have time for this." Sitting on a log, staring into the distance, was Mouse. Mouse was definitely not busy. Mouse was just looking into the distance and wondering if that tree over there looked like an ice cream cone or a spaceship, when he spotted a very bothered-looking pigeon. "Can I help you?" asked Mouse. "Yes, I'm very, very busy, and I'm very, very lost. I have a very important thing to do, and I need to be doing it now."
"Oh, dear," said Mouse. "Perhaps I could help?"
"Yes, perhaps you could, but I'm very busy. So, if you could be quick about it."
"Oh, yes, of course," said Mouse. "Quick, quick, absolutely."
So Mouse started to lead the way. They hadn't been walking long when Mouse stopped to investigate an interesting-looking leaf. "Ha, Pigeon, this leaf looks just like your foot."
"No time for that, Mouse," huffed Pigeon. "Much too busy for that."
So they trudged on. Soon, Mouse came across a perfectly white feather.
"Oh, look, Pigeon, it's just a feather, if you ask me," grumbled Pigeon.
"No, no, absolutely not. We do not have time for feathers, Mouse."
"But it looks just like a..."
So they went on. As they came to a clearing, Mouse pointed excitedly up to the sky.
"Well, Pigeon, will you look at that? Well, that cloud looks just like a dog."
"Nonsense, Mouse," said Pigeon. "It's a cloud like any other cloud. Now, can we please just hurry up?"
So they went, Mouse all the time looking around him,
while Pigeon stared at his feet and thought about all the very important things he should be doing. But the sky was growing dark, and Mouse suddenly wasn't quite sure which way to go.
"You're right, Pigeon," said Mouse. "This is hopeless. I should have been looking where we were going and not at all those silly things around me.
Now we're both lost." Pigeon stopped walking, and for the first time, he stopped thinking about all the things he should be doing. He heard birds cheeping. He heard the rustle of leaves in the trees. He heard his own thoughts, and he heard Mouse.
"No, no, that's nonsense, Mouse. This is a wonderful forest. Look at it all. And look, can't you see? That rock over there looks just like a cat."
Mouse looked, and it did. The rock really did look like a cat.
"Oh, yes, I do see, Pigeon." So they both stopped and stared and admired the funny-looking rock.
"Do you know what else I see, Pigeon?"
"I can see the road and your way home."
"Oh, well, that's nice," said Pigeon. "But let's just sit here for a while and enjoy the forest, shall we?"
And that's exactly what they did. Alone. There once was a boy called Billy McGill who lived by himself on the top of a hill. He spent every day in his house all alone, for Billy McGill liked to be on his own. "This is my hill," said Billy McGill. "I live here alone, always have, always will." Splendid aloneness. Yes, that was the aim. So nobody called and nobody came. Life was so fast down below in the town, with the people, the traffic, the rushing around, the hustle and bustle, the coming and going. The world never stopped with its toying and froing. But life on the hill stayed exactly the same. Nobody called, nobody came. "This is my hill," said Billy McGill. "I live here alone. Always have, always will." From morning to night, and all the year round, there was barely a whisper and hardly a sound. Not a plip, not a plop, not a hum, not a creak. Till one day, the horror, a scratch and a squeak. Billy searched high and low and all over the house, until under the bed he discovered a mouse. "No," Billy muttered, "I can't accept that." So he went into town and he brought back a cat. "This is my hill," said Billy McGill. "I live here alone, always have, always will. This cat will give chase to the mouse, yes it will. And then pence will return to my house on the hill." But the cat liked to play, and the mouse was the same, and they both thought the chase was a wonderful game. "Oh, no," Billy cried. "It's a dog that I need. I'll chase off this cat and this mouse with great speed." But the dog joined the game with the cat and the mouse, and they ran round in circles all over the house. "Oh, no," Billy cried. "What they need is a scare." So he went to the zoo and snuck out with a bear. But the bear felt quite tired, and with hardly a peep, he and the cat and the dog fell asleep. "Oh, no," Billy cried. "I must wake them up quick." A roar from a tiger just might do the trick. But the tiger he fetched had a terrible sneeze, and the roar, when it came, was no more than a wheeze. "This won't do," Billy said. "I must get him a vet, for I will get rid of these animals yet." "This is my hill," said Billy McGill. "I live here alone, always have, always will." The vet, when she came, said, "Let's knit him a sweater. This beast has a cold. It will make him feel better." "I can do it for you. You must get me some wool. Find a sheep with a coat that is fluffy and full." So the sheep Billy found was as big as a cloud. "How on earth will I clip it?" he wondered aloud. "My friend's a hairdresser. He'll know what to do," said the vet. "He will shear this sheep nicely for you." So the vet asked her friend, "Can you help?" He said, "Maybe, as long as you're there to look after my baby." "This is my hill," said Billy McGill. "I live here alone, always have, always will." Well, as soon as they came, the poor babe started crying, and the hairdresser said, "There's just no use in trying. I can't shear the sheep while my baby's upset. We must get him a toy. Oh, the poor little pet." "To the toy shop," said Billy. "I'll be back very soon." He returned with a fabulous bright red balloon. "Oh, how perfectly chosen," the hairdresser said. his favorite color has always been red. But just at that moment, the wind began blowing. The house was besieged by a thunderstorm growing. The balloon disappeared in a gust through the door. The hairdresser screamed. The baby cried, "Sore!" "Enough," Billy roared. "I can't take any more. All this noise and confusion, and what is it for? This is my hill. I am Billy McGill. I live here alone, always have, always will." With a huff and a puff and a miserable frown, he trekked off through the rain to the far side of town. And beyond, through the valley and over the sea, to a place high and lonely where no one would be. "Now this is my hill," said Billy McGill. "I live on my own. Always have, always will." The evening grew cold, and as the sun set, he thought of the tiger, the sheep, and the vet, and the dog, and the bear, and the hairdresser, too. And just then, a red balloon blew into view, and the poor little baby popped into his head, the baby whose favorite color was red. He reached for the string and went down the hill and over the sea. He kept going until he had passed through the town and arrived at his house, the one with the dog and the cat and the mouse. There was noise and confusion and poop everywhere, and the sheep was asleep with the bear on the chair. "I'll fix this," said Billy. "I'll fix it all soon." And he handed the baby the bright red balloon. The baby stopped crying and fell fast asleep. And the hairdresser set about shearing the sheep. The vet made a sweater. The tiger soon wore. And the tiger, much better, recovered its roar. The bear, in a panic, ran out of the house, chasing after the dog and the cat and the mouse. The rest of them left in a minute or so, and Billy was pleased to see everyone go. "This is my hill," said Billy McGill. "I live here alone, always have, always will." Now Billy is happy, and peace is restored. His house on the hill is in chaos no more. There's hardly a whisper, there's barely a sound, except every Tuesday when friends come around. And the last picture shows everybody there, the hairdresser, the tiger, the baby, the cat, and the bear. You are home. You might have thought that home was four walls and a floor, a door, and a window or two. Until that home goes up in a puff of smoke, leaving only a soggy, blackened outline of what once was. Maybe home was always metal and wheels, with a pop-up top overflowing with laughter and sometimes shouts. Yesterday's cooking mixed with tomorrow's plans, until you move into a palace built of air and clouds, brimming with life's breath, only stars for a roof, a planet or two, and the moon to guide you. There you find home, in a moment of stillness, carved from the day, full of potential, but not yet filled, waiting on the verge of newness. You might emerge from the cramped safety of a truck, only a box to shield you as you move uncertainly, learning the curve of this strange sidewalk, heart pulsing, quick, wondering, "Did I leave home behind?" Then, just when you thought home was lost forever, stuffed in an old box and taped up, mislabeled, left under the porch or scattered somewhere along life's rutted road, someone reaches out to you gently, patiently, and as you open a book, chairs pulled together, flipping pages in perfect harmony, first their turn, then yours, home seems closer with every word you read. Cookies baking, cozy bed, hiding places, room for toys. You picture the home of your dreams, imagination bright, and look up triumphantly, only to realize that no one else has seen it until a new friend brushes their favorite shade of purple through the sky. The soft glow of a setting sun lighting up your home for all to see. A shared discovery that brings a smile to your eyes. Together, you create home in that space between day and night that can be oh so short. Or stretch on forever, balancing blankets on branches, settling into your tree fort with soft giggles. You decide that home is something you carry close wherever you go, like a turtle, secure in its shell, and as an oyster shelters a pearl. You hold wisdom so uniquely, you, that no one gets to know, until you share it with them. You build your home with kindness, given and gotten, forging connections, strengthening bonds until you see that you're in this together and you know that you belong. Home is a memory. Home is a dream. Home is right here, right now, and you are home. Chidori, a story of 1,000 birds. Hannah's school sat on the side of the hill that overlooked her village. She wished she could see the fish market where her mother worked or the long winding road her father had driven that morning. But there was only ocean and the plump little plovers that hopped above the waves along the shore. Her mother loved to paint these little seabirds. In front of the school was the large rock her mother had chosen to be their daily meeting place. By the time school finished, her mother would be waiting there to walk Hannah home. But before the end of the day bell rang, Hannah heard a rumbling sound. Her desk swayed, making her pencils slide to the floor. Then the chalk bounced from the ledges and books tumbled from the shelves as the whole school shook from the earthquake. Quickly, Hannah followed the line of children outside. A siren sounded. Crowds of people filled the pathway, fleeing a wave of dark water. They all watched it crush the forest of pines along the shore. Hannah held her breath, wondering if the trees would be all right. The sudden sound of a helicopter made everyone jump. "We must move to higher ground," the teacher insisted. From the roof of the school, everyone stared at the wave. Like a monster in a bad dream, it pushed the fishing boats into a screeching, creaking mountain of wood. It dragged the ocean across the village, tossing cars and trucks like toys. Eventually, as if it were tired from all it had done, the wave rested. A woman with a clipboard and phone asked Hannah's name.
Mother will be looking for me, Hannah said. Please call her. Someone whispered. The fish market was swept away. Hannah turned away and wrapped herself in a blanket. Mother will swim back. Many days later, Hannah heard the familiar sound of her father's truck. Why did you take so long? Hannah asked him. Did you bring mother? But it was Obasan, her grandmother, who got out of the truck, not her mother. Even with his head bowed, Hannah could see her father's wet eyes. A wave, darker than the one that had taken their village, washed over Hannah's heart. They had to stay in a house with walls so thin she could hear the tears of her neighbors. I will teach you to paint, Obasan said, just like I once taught your mother. The Sumi'i lessons brought Hannah a free floating feeling, like she was rising above her sorrow. When all the water had returned to the ocean, Obasan, Hannah, and Hannah's father followed the path to where they had once lived. On the shore, all that was left of the thick forest was one lone pine tree. Where did all the birds go? Hannah asked her grandmother. They knew to fly up the hill, Obasan reassured her. Hannah thought about her mother's smiling face as she painted the plovers. She wished the birds had told mother to follow them. In the village, rubble from destroyed buildings and the splintered remains of furniture and fences filled the streets. Hannah found one of her mother's white-haired paintbrushes lying on a rock, as if it were waiting for her. While other villagers searched for their belongings, Hannah painted a plover on the side of her ruined house. She found another place to paint and another, until 1,000 birds reached the top of the hill. On the special meeting rock, Hannah painted two. Here's the author's note. Chindori means 1,000 birds. The Japanese character for chindori is also used for plover. Japan has many species of plovers, which arrive in large groups at the end of the rainy season, facing waves, rain, and wind. For many centuries, this bird has been a symbol of courage and determination. Plovers are often depicted flying above the waves, evoking the ability to overcome the difficulties of life. The people of the Awate Prefecture faced many difficulties in 2011 when a tsunami, a powerful wave triggered by a large earthquake under the ocean, swept the land. The lone pine tree that remained on the shore motivated the survivors of this great disaster to replant. Its endurance encouraged the broken hearts of those who had lost loved ones. And I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled All the Beating Hearts. Each day starts with the sun and hopefully something to eat and something to wear and possibly somewhere to go or somewhere to stay. And the day will be full of what daytimes are always full of, work or play or work and play, and sometimes nothing much at all. And we will watch the clouds from where we stand, and the birds will come and go, and some things will grow and overflow, and other things will turn into something new. or shrivel up, or fade away, and some things will die. And along the way, there will be love with its arms wrapped around us tight. And some days, we will curl up and wish to be any other place. And sometimes, we'll be filled right up to the top with the feeling that everything is exactly right. And the night will always come too, and then we will find our sleeping place, and maybe we will read or sing before we close our eyes and drift into a dream. Hopefully a good one, but sometimes not. And for a little while, there we are, all just hearts, beating in the darkness, strong and steady and sure. Each beat a reminder that we are here and alive, together but apart, the same but exactly different. And for just a little while, there in the dark, that is all we need to be. And then the sun shines us into a brand new day, a day that is bright and blinding and full. And everyone is busy being everywhere and everything else. And all those beating hearts are still there, but struggling to be heard above it all. Each beat begging us to remember that we are already everything we need to be, here and alive, together but apart, the same but exactly different. And nothing needs to be heard except for our beating hearts, strong and steady and sure. And this is just a reminder, my name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 2 months, titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. Jack Henry, the hero of Heads or Tails, Stories from the Sixth Grade, is back. It is summer after sixth grade, and Jack and his offbeat family have relocated to the island of Barbados. Jack hopes he's escaping the craziness of his old life in Florida. But even in a Caribbean paradise, he is plagued by misadventure. He gets a violent case of blood poisoning and ends up painted purple from head to toe. Discovers the perils of male bonding in a pepper-eating contest with his father. And has his heartstrings twanged by an older woman, his sister's best friend, to name just a few of his troubles. But in these 8 fierce and funny stories, Jack always perseveres, sometimes with the help of one of the few reliable things in his life, his trusty diary. Okay, last week I started the 4th story, which is titled New Power. And Jack got in trouble with his dad for accidentally breaking his office window while throwing rocks at bats. Jack is 13, but is tired of being treated like a boy, and he wants to be treated like a man. His mom just left. She went back to Pennsylvania, and is leaving Jack with his dad and his older sister. Jack is now fishing with his dad. And that's where I left off last week. The first one to catch a fish gets to send the other guy to the bar to get drinks, Dad said. Okay, it was a fair deal. That's what I liked about fishing. It put us on equal ground. You cast out your line, and the fish don't know the difference between a man and a boy. Dad reared back and cast his chrome triple-hooked spinner. The line spun off the reel. Plop. It landed about 50 yards away. He let it sink down and slowly reeled it in with his thumb pressed against the spool of line to feel for bites. He was going for big bottom feeders like grouper and triggerfish.
I took a different approach. I opened my tackle box and attached a bobber to my line, then got my secret weapon, a dragonfly. I put it on the hook and gently cast it out so it floated about 20 feet from the rocks. I was after surface feeders, especially red snapper, which was my favorite. Together, we stood there with our rods pressed against our bellies like two guys peeing off a dock. Suddenly, my bobber went under. I counted 1, 2, 3. I jerked back on the rod to set the hook and reeled it in. The fish didn't put up much of a fight, but it was the first one caught. A bluegill, about the size of my hand. I won, I hollered. I'll take a lemon squash. Well, you didn't win, he replied. That's not a fish, that's bait. You didn't say how big it had to be. You just said it had to be a fish. Well, you cheated, he said. Anyone can catch a fish like that. I could have just stuck the net in the water and caught one of those. Now you have to get the drinks. No way, I said. I won. You haven't caught anything yet. Don't argue with me, he replied. You cheated. Besides, I'm Payne. Now fetch. I'll take a Banks in the bottle. And tell the bartender your dad wants it ice cold. I threw my fish back into the water and took the money from his hand. Bully, I thought to myself. There is no winning with someone who won't play by the rules. By the time I returned, he had seen a few of his friends and waved them over. They sat down on the rocks to shoot the breeze, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. I recast my line and drank my soda. I should have talked Shiva into running, I thought. It would be a lot more fun than watching Dad and his pals talk. And then I remembered what I told him about the prunes. I hoped he didn't take my advice. I was sure he knew better. Everyone knew what prunes could do to you. The next morning, Betsy and I were standing at the edge of the driveway. I looked up at Dad's window. It was still broken. Don't you get tired of being treated like a kid? I asked. She frowned. Nobody treats me like a kid. Well, don't you hate it when adults say things like, do as I say, don't do as I do? Just ignore them, she said. Doesn't it bug you that you never get a vote on where to live, what to eat, where to go to school, what clothes to buy? What are you whining about? She shot back. You are always complaining about something. You are the last person I would want making a decision around here. If it wasn't for Dad, you'd be living in a refrigerator box and raiding garbage cans for dinner. I could tell whose side she was on. I missed Pete already. He usually agreed with me. A month of Betsy and Dad, and I'd be a nervous wreck. We were standing at the edge of the driveway when a car raced up the street and aimed straight for us. It was a big old American car with a huge hood ornament. And as it got closer, it looked like a charging rhinoceros. Betsy stood her ground, but I jumped behind a fence post as it hit the brakes and skidded to a stop. Get in, squeaked a little voice. The driver was a bug-eyed maniac. He was skinny, sat on a pillow, and scratched at a bald spot on his head that looked like a rug burn. He smoked unfiltered cigarettes and had a lead foot. Betsy took the front seat and sneered at him. I climbed in the back with two boys who must have been brothers about my age and Pete's. They were pale, sweaty, and terrified. We took off with a lurch and peeled rubber up to the corner, where he took the right-hand turn without slowing to look. The car tilted like a canoe about to flip over. I tumbled across the seat and crunched into the two boys. They both grabbed their crotches and moaned. "Sorry," I mumbled. The car straightened out, and we raced a taxi to the red light, where we came to a screeching stop. The three of us bounced off the back of the front seat and fell to the floor. When I pulled myself up, I was thrown back as the light turned green and our driver floored it. Betsy had her shoes propped against the dashboard and her right hand gripped the overhead strap. Her left hand was pressed against the side of the maniac's face, so he could only see with one eye. "Slow down," she yelled. He laughed and speeded up, then jerked his head out the window to get a better view. The engine roared as he pulled out to pass a line of slower cars and bicycles. I glanced at the two boys. "Okay," the older one said to the younger, "now's your chance. We're on a straight stretch." The speedometer needle was up to 75, and we were passing everything on the road. If anyone pulled out in front of us, we'd be dead meat. When I turned back toward the boys, I was shocked. They both had their pants down and were pulling plastic bags of pee off their private parts. The bags had been held on with rubber bands. The older brother, who was next to the door, threw his out the window. He then reached for his brother's full bag. It was a delicate operation, made even more difficult because the bag was so full. Before he could swing it out the window, we hit a curve at 70, and the three of us were pressed against his door with my face about an inch away from the dripping pee bag. In an instant, we straightened up, and he tossed the bag out the window before we took a curve on my side. When we straightened out again, the younger one attached a fresh pee bag to his privates and yanked his pants back up. I looked at the older brother. "He scares us so much we wet our pants," he shouted over the blast of air, which was screaming through the open windows. "This is all we can do to stop it." Just then, the maniac hit the brakes, and we went into a sideways skid down a dirt road. We came out of the fishtail and quickly pulled into a driveway. Overhead was a sign which read, "Awak Summer Camp." We came to a stop inches from another car and scared the passengers into ducking down. The two boys hopped out. "See you later," I said, as we spun out in a cloud of dust and flying gravel. Up the road, we pulled into another driveway. "Presentation Youth College," read the sign. As soon as we came to a stop, Betsy reached across the dashboard and pulled the keys out of the ignition. She jumped out of her side and threw them into a field of grass. "Hey, you can't do that," the maniac squealed. He sounded like an angry chihuahua. Betsy raised her fist to his chin. "I just did it," she growled. "So what are you going to do about it, you little runt?" He turned and ran into the field. He dropped down onto his knees and scratched up the ground. "Coward," she hollered. "It's not nice to scare kids." "That goes double for me," I yelled. Betsy turned around and gave me the evil eye. "Oh, shut up," she carped. "You sound tough now, but all you did was bounce around back there like a bowl of yellow jello." She was right. I hadn't lifted a finger to help out. "What could I have done?" I asked. "You should have covered his eyes with your hands." I imagined just how helpful that would have been. We went inside and found our class assignments. which were listed according to grades. There were half a dozen other kids about my age scattered throughout my room. They weren't Americans, so I figured other countries were also dishing out crummy educations. I took a seat next to the window so I could daydream. Suddenly, a very stubby, thick man marched into the room. "Rise and stand quiet," he ordered. We all stood. He set his briefcase down on the desk. "My name is Mr. Cucumber," he said, as though he were angry about it. "I've been teaching for 10 years. During that time, I have expelled 10 students. Do you know why?" I did, but didn't dare answer. "The first person to make fun of my name will repeat 6th grade. No ifs, ands, or buts. Period. You all understand?" We nodded mutely. "Sit," he ordered. We dropped down like sandbags. He sat behind his desk, leaned back, and folded his hands behind his huge, bald head. "Today is your last chance for a summer free from school. In my briefcase," he tapped it with a long wooden pointer, tap, 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 "I have exams that will measure your knowledge of English, mathematics, world history, and science. If you pass all 4 subjects, you don't come back until September. If you fail even one, you have me 5 days a week for 6 weeks in a row until I mash some knowledge into your empty brains." I could not think of one fact I knew for sure about any of those subjects. I peeked at the other students. They looked as sweaty and empty-headed as me. Mr. Cucumber stood, removed the test, and placed one face down on each of our desks. "You will have an hour per section," he explained, and checked his watch. "The first section is math. Go." I turned over my exam. I was sunk right away. I didn't even get a chance to have some tiny bit of false hope. The first problem was in meters, kilometers, decimeters, grams, and liters. I skipped that problem and leafed through the entire section. It was not multiple choice. I knew right away what I'd be doing for the next 6 weeks. My head drooped over like a hanged man's. I asked myself, how many meters of rope does it take to make a noose? I did all the math I could, then quit. When the hour was up, we had a 10-minute break. I ran to find Betsy. She was at the water fountain. When she saw me, she asked, how many grams in an ounce? I threw up my hands. Looks like I'll have the house to myself while Mom's away, she said with supreme confidence. Hey, just wait till you get to science, I said as snottily as I could. Already did it, she sang. I skipped ahead. I felt like an idiot. At the end of the day, the tests were graded before we went home. No one in my group passed. If you study, 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 said Mr. Cucumber when he called me to his desk, you might make it. I felt doomed. One final question, he asked before I left. Is a cucumber a vegetable or a tuber or a berry? This had to be a trick question. I always thought it was a vegetable. A tuber, I guessed. It's going to be a long summer, he replied, and grinned like a Rottweiler. He did not look like a vegetarian. He was definitely a meat eater. When I went outside, Betsy was surrounded by other girls her age. They listened to every word she said. I thought they were going to drop down and kiss her feet. I squeezed in between her fans. Guess what? She said to me and flicked her hair back and looked more glamorous. I did so well, I get to skip a grade. And you? I had to turn things around. I was going downhill fast. Dad was kicking my butt, Mr. Cucumber was a fiend. Betsy was an instant success at everything, and I was a loser. I really miss Pete. It was his job to be on the bottom of the barrel. Now the entire barrel was sitting on me. I couldn't get any lower. "Don't wait for me," Betsy said as I dropped my head in shame. "I have a different ride home." "Great," I thought as I walked around front. "Leave me with the maniac. The way he drives, they'll soon be hosing my face off the front grill of a tractor trailer." When the midget turned into the driveway, he headed for me like a locomotive that had jumped track. The two boys were already bouncing around in the rear like loose packages. I took the back seat with them, and we blasted down the driveway and ran a car off the road. When we made our first turn, he hit the gas, and I thought of covering his eyes with my hands, but didn't. "Coward," I said to myself. "Wimp, chicken, yellow-bellied sapsucker. Betsy is more of a man than you are." We took a turn and nearly hit a goat. After another dozen killer turns, we got to the straightaway. The boys desperately yanked down their pants and pulled off their pee bags. "Give me that," I said, and grabbed the dripping bag out of the younger boy's hands. I leaned forward and poured it over the maniac's head. He sputtered and turned around. I was waiting for him with the second bag. Splash! I got him right in the face. He hit the brakes and reached for me. We skidded across the road, hit the curb, bounced up, and slammed into a chain-link fence. He stopped the car like a big steel net. The maniac screamed and hit the floor. We bounced off the seat. "Come on, boys," I said. "Follow me." We crawled out the window as a crowd gathered. I flagged down a cab. "Get in," I said. They did, and we got stuck in traffic and inched our way down the road along with the other cars, donkeys, goats, and bicycles. The boys just stared at me as if I were the maniac. Ingrates, I thought to myself. When the taxi dropped me off in front of the house, I paid the driver with money. Mom had left me, then swaggered up the front steps like a big man. "Don't mess with me," I growled and pounded my chest. "I'll pour pee on your head." It was Sunday. With Mom gone, Dad worked 7 days a week. This morning, he was running late and was trotting around his truck. A pipe was sticking out of the overhead rack. It was head high and just a little bit longer than the truck bed. Each time Dad ran around the truck, getting tools, moving equipment, checking supplies, he ducked the pipe. He did it without looking, as if it was something he had practiced. I stood in the kitchen window, eating toast, and beamed telepathic thoughts at him. As he headed for the pipe, I thought, "Duck." He ducked. As he came back around, I thought, "Duck." He ducked. Suddenly, he snapped his fingers and doubled back to get something he remembered. "Don't duck," I thought. Bonk! He hit the pipe, and his feet went straight out beneath him, and he landed flat on his back. I ran down the stairs and knelt over him. I slapped his cheeks back and forth. "Not so hard," I warned myself. He might come to in a bad mood. He was breathing, but he was out cold. A huge lump popped up on his forehead, like in a cartoon. I ran into the house to get some ice. When I came out, he was sitting up with his chin on his knees. He saw me and grinned. "Ow," he whistled and shook it off. "That was some sucker punch you hit me with." "That wasn't me," I said. But I felt guilty for thinking, "Don't duck." "No kidding," he replied, and hopped up onto his feet, then wiped the dirt off his pants. "You'd have to hit me a hell of a lot harder than that to get rid of your old man."
He examined himself in the side mirror and combed his hair. He removed his handkerchief and wiped a smudge off his lump.
"Wow, see you later," he said, ducking under the pipe and opening the driver's side door. "Don't forget to give Bobo, too, a flea bath. He smells."
He pulled away, and I strolled around to the front yard. Bobo, too, wasn't under the shade tree. "Bobo the second," I yelled down the street. I heard him barking over by Hal's Hunt's garage. I walked over there. Hal had Bobo, too, trapped in a corner and was throwing bullets at him. He had a box of shells in his hands, and every time he threw one, he jumped up into the air as if the bullet were going to fire and he could skip over it. "Dumb smelly dog," Hal shouted, and he threw another bullet. Bobo, too, looked puzzled. He needed a nap. He was only good for about an hour of energy each day, and his time had expired.
"Hey, what are you doing?" I hollered. He whipped around and raised his arm over his head.
"Watch it, Henry," he growled. "I've got a bullet in my hand."
"You watch it," I growled back. "With the power of my mind, I can make that bullet explode between your fingers." I squinted and touched my fingertips to my forehead. I stared at the bullet and concentrated. Hal looked at me. I could tell that he wasn't certain if I was bluffing. I wasn't sure either, but I had just knocked Dad cold, so I figured I could set off a bullet. I narrowed my eyes and concentrated so hard I moaned. My muscles knotted up, and I began to tremble. Suddenly, he twisted away from my paralyzing mental grip and threw the bullet into the bushes. "You must be a devil," he cried out and stared into his hand.
"Don't mess with me," I said, lowering my hands. "I know where you live, and my power is strong enough to cross the street. I can just look at your house and make pictures fall off the walls." Then I turned to Bobo, too. "Come on, Smelly," I said. He followed dutifully.
But unfortunately, this is all the time that we have for today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.